Elkhorn and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, up next. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from Carthage College, reminding you that this weekend is Carthage's homecoming, and Carthage homecoming culminates with a special concert Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock in Siebert Chapel, a concert which will feature guest performances by two of Carthage's alums, as well as performances by the Wind Ensemble and the Carthage College Choir. 2 o'clock Sunday afternoon. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD HD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm tremendously excited to share with you today the interview which I recorded earlier this week with best-selling author Jennifer Chiaverini. She has a host of best-selling works to her credit, including the wildly popular 17-volume set of Elm Creek quilt novels. Also to her credit, 4 standalone historic novels, Mrs. Lincoln's Dressmaker, The Spy Mistress, Mrs. Lincoln's Rival, and Mrs. Grant and Madame Jules. Her 5th historic novel has just been published, and it is called Fates and Traitors, a novel of John Wilkes Booth. All of us know the name John Wilkes Booth, but most of us know little or nothing about his background beyond the fact that he was an actor and that, of course, he assassinated our 16th president, Abraham Lincoln. What drove him to that deed? We come to know John Wilkes Booth and his inner mental and emotional life through the eyes of 4 women very important to him. His mother, Mary Ann Holmes Booth, his devoted sister, Asia, who later went on to write a biography about her brother, a young woman by the name of Lucy Hale, the daughter of a senator from New England, who was very likely the love of John Wilkes Booth's life, and finally, Mary Surratt, who ended up being one of the 4 conspirators hung for the crime of conspiring to assassinate President Lincoln. It is through these women that we come to know in a really profound way who John Wilkes Booth was. Jennifer Chiaverini is coming to Kenosha next week, Wednesday, September 28th, for a book signing event at the Northside Kenosha Public Library. That event is open to the public and it begins at 6:30. Once again, the title of Jennifer Chiaverini's latest novel is Fates and Traitors, a novel of John Wilkes Booth, published by Dutton. I asked Jennifer Chiaverini to explain the most valuable resources to which she turned in doing all of the research which allowed her to write this richly detailed novel.
Well, if I had to single out one particular author's work, I think I would have to point to his sister Asia's account that she wrote of her brother. And she also wrote other, she was a family author, she was a family historian, and she loved her brother very much. She wrote a memoir of him, and she also wrote biographies of their father, the renowned actor Junius Brutus Booth, and she wrote some other books as well, and all of them were published after the assassination. So, and in fact, some of them were not published until after her death. So Asia's book about her brother gave me insight into episodes from his childhood that were clearly very formative. His education, the very difficult struggles that the family had just to keep from starving after Junius Brutus Booth's death, his desire to be an actor, and his feelings of frustration when he could never quite equal his elder brother Edwin in talent and success. But even though this was enormously helpful, I, of course, had to keep in mind as I was reading that this was written not by an objective scholar, but as a loving and grieving elder sister. So I did have to keep that in mind when I was evaluating the way that she described her brother and her account of various events. So if I had to single out just one person, I would, of course, focus on her. As you probably know, there are volumes and volumes written about John Wilkes Booth and the conspiracy. And so I did have to focus on certain books that were perhaps more written more recently, so it wasn't quite so close to the past as to be influenced by any personal friendship with anybody involved. But I also just love to get back to those primary documents, journals, memoirs, letters that various people sent to one another. Testimony offered at the conspiracy trial was also very important. And then, too, I love to look at historic newspapers, not so much for the factual evidence, because then, as now, sometimes the media had to go to print. The papers had to go to print before all the facts were in. We find that today, as a story is unfolding, we get some preliminary information that, upon later reflection, turns out not to be the case. So that might seem to lead me astray, or you might think that it would. On the other hand, it does give me great insight into what my characters would have been discovering about the events in real time. So, you know, from my 21st century perspective, I know what happened after John Wilkes Booth shot the president and fled Washington, D.C. It's been accounted for almost hour by hour. But Mary Ann, his mother, and Asia, his sister, and Lucy, his sweetheart, and Mary Surratt, his co-conspirator, they did not know. And they were getting bits and pieces of news in the newspaper and through gossip, just as we would in a similar situation today. So it really allowed me to really try to feel what my characters might have been feeling when they heard false reports or more hopeful reports that he had been spotted in Canada or he had escaped to Texas and he was safe. And then, of course, that he had already been captured and killed. So I would be allowed to really see the events unfolding as my characters would have been experiencing them.
Hmm. We certainly get a sense of that, and I so appreciate it. That makes the book all the more vibrant. Something else that I really appreciate is the fact that you give us a sense of what life was like, for instance, during the Civil War, apart from the Civil War, in a sense. And I've been thinking about this a lot because I just interviewed the editor of a really interesting book, believe it or not, called Who Shot Sports? A History of Sports Photography. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because one of the earliest photographs in this book is of a baseball team in 1865, and they had been three-year national champions at that point. And I realized when I saw that photograph, it had never dawned on me that during the Civil War, anybody was playing baseball. I mean, right. It was just a ludicrous notion. It would never dawn on me that such a thing were possible. And, of course, in your book, even as we are, in a sense, learning about the events of the war, which of course predominate everything, the fact is that people are still going to the theater. People are still going to the opera. People are still going out for dinner. That a remarkable bit of normal living is going on, even as this devastating war is being fought. I wonder what kind of a challenge it was to, in a sense, bring this part of our history to light, since it is, generally speaking, so obscured by the specter of the war itself.
Well, I think it is significant that this is a Civil War novel that is set more on the home front, and that's largely because of my choice of these foreign narrators. They were not off serving in the war, so we didn't really get an opportunity, and they didn't experience the battlefield. I did talk about that in the previous book, Mrs. Grant and Madame Jewel, because one of my narrators, Julia Grant, the wife of then-General Ulysses S. Grant, she was often with him on the battlefield, at military headquarters. She wasn't out on the front lines. And so she had a very different perspective of the war. So I was able to examine that from her point of view in that previous book. But this was really more about being on the home front of experiencing not the battle, but the fear of having loved ones far away and of the determination to do what they could at home to support the troops and to rally to the cause of the Union Army, or, of course, in Mary Surratt's case, working as a spy, having, encouraging her youngest son in his endeavors to be a Confederate courier. And, of course, before she came to Washington, D.C., to run that infamous boarding house where the conspirators often met, she ran a tavern in Maryland that was a safe house for spies and couriers traveling from the South through the North. So I was able to show how these women, although they didn't take up arms and march off with a regiment, how they did their part to support the cause and to support especially their own loved ones who were involved in it, whether they were supporting the Confederacy or the Union. And Lucy Hale, I think, had a very interesting perspective on this as the daughter of a New Hampshire senator, because then, too, we get to see some of the political aspects of what went on in Washington while this war was being fought and while President Lincoln was struggling to hold the Union together.
Hmm. Before we dig into a few more specifics about these four women and about the life of John Wilkes Booth, I wonder if I could ask you a question that probably doesn't even matter all that much, and yet I'm kind of curious. And I guess in the crassest sense, sort of terms, the question is, how much of this book is true? and in the sense that this is a novel, to some extent it's a work of fiction, but deeply steeped in history. And yet you are obviously, for instance, creating conversations from your own imagination, coupled with
exactly
this bountiful amount of research that you have done. I'm not sure if I'm asking for a mathematical proportion here or maybe just kind of a general sense, because I think in some respects it might be helpful for the reader to know that. And on the other hand, maybe you don't particularly want us even thinking about that matter of how much of this actually occurred and how much of this springs from your imagination. What should we do with that question? Should we not ask it at all of ourselves or of you?
I think it's a fine question to ask. Lots of readers ask it, and I think because we put, a novel on the cover, then I think readers know this is a work of fiction. But when you're reading about something, and I know this for myself too, I love reading historical fiction, and I have the same question myself. Well, you want to know, what part of this actually did happen, and what part of this is embellishment? Well, for every author, you have a different line that you draw. With historical fiction, you can change as much as you like. You have license to do that. You're not supposed to do that quite so much when you're writing nonfiction. People expect you absolutely to stick to the facts. for me, I like to adhere to the historical record to the extent that I can and to the extent that it is known. I won't, for example, move a Civil War battle to a different year because it's more convenient for my storyline. I won't invent a sibling because I think it would be more interesting for President Lincoln to be chatting with his twin brother, for example. That's a pretty crazy example, but there you have it. However, when it comes to characters who are not as significant to this story, I do feel like I have a little more leeway to perhaps make them a composite character or invent someone entirely new. But you're absolutely right to point out that anything that deals with private conversations that no one else would have overheard and recorded, or feelings or thoughts, all of that sort of thing, whether you're reading my books or someone else, you need to just assume that that is invented. What I try to do is to learn as much about the historical figures that I am using as fictional characters as much as I can, to get a good sense of who they were, how they spoke, how they approached other people, and also how they were seen by others. And then I try to stay true to what I do know about the person when I am creating this imagined life for all that I don't know. However, something to keep in mind about the historical record is that it is very often incomplete, and in some cases it's just entirely wrong. There are huge gaps in the historical record, things that people just didn't write down, or there's no documentation to tell us about what happened or what the people were thinking or even who was in the room. And also, even when we do have something, a memoir, a journal, a letter, a newspaper article, sometimes either deliberately or just through human error, sometimes there are mistakes. I think we all have remembered things incorrectly. Perhaps we've written to a letter to a friend talking about something that we did on Tuesday, although it really was a month ago and it was on a Friday. Or we remember quite clearly going to this restaurant before we went to that theater and saw that show, and then looking back a year later, wait a minute, that restaurant wasn't even open then. So even though that's how I remember it, that can't be what really happened. And of course, we've all written the wrong date on a check, for example. We've all put the wrong year down on it, so even though it's documented, that doesn't mean it's true. And also, even in letters, even in our own journals and diaries, we're not always honest. Sometimes we have things we want to conceal. Sometimes we want to make ourselves look better. But even memoirs and diaries aren't always necessarily the factual truth. So what I like to think of is that we have the historical record. We have historical fact. And then we have historical fiction, which is more of, it talks more about what could have happened, even if it necessarily didn't happen. So instead of thinking of historical fact and historical fiction as polar opposites, I like to think of them as different approaches, as different tools for getting at historical truth.
Nicely put. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with best-selling author Jennifer Chiaverini. We are talking about her most recent work, which is called Fates and Traitors, a novel of John Wilkes Booth. I love the way this book begins, the very first chapter. But ahead of that, all the way through this novel are excerpts from various Shakespeare plays. Just say a word about why those are there and sort of the process by which you chose each particular excerpt that appears here.
Well, the Booth family, all of the members were deeply steeped in drama, especially Shakespeare, because Junius Brutus Booth was known as this wonderful Shakespearean actor. And, of course, he did other works as well. But he recited the plays, he recited, he would act them out in front of the children, and so he enthralled them with the language and the drama and the characters from a very young age. And they were all just very admiring of their father, despite his faults, and there were many that they admired him very much. But he was making these plays and Shakespearean drama accessible to the children very early on, even though he was adamant that he didn't want any of his children to follow in his footsteps and become actors. Well, with all of the training he was giving them inadvertently, and with all of the excitement that he was surrounding them in when he would recite these great soliloquies, I think it was little wonder that three of his children did decide to become actors. John Wilkes Booth, of course, but also his elder brother Edwin, and the eldest of the Booth children, Junius Brutus Booth Jr. So it was such an important part of the Booth family's lives that it just naturally came through the story over and over again. And I tried to bring this in, too, not just with the phrases that I begin each chapter with, but also with the identification John Wilkes Booth had with the character of Brutus from Julius Caesar. He very early on saw Brutus quite differently than his sister Asia did, for example. He saw Brutus as the hero of that story, not Mark Antony and certainly not Caesar himself. And they even argued about this. And later on, he has a similar conversation with Lucy. And I thought that it was especially important to focus on this play, Julius Caesar, because it was the only play. There was a performance in 1864 in New York City, and that was the only time that the three Booth brothers appeared on the stage together. So to me, that was something that it was especially important to include in the novel, because it just seemed to be this thread that followed John Wilkes Booth throughout his life.
Hmm. So you begin your book with, in a sense, the moment at the very end of John Wilkes Booth's life. We are with him in that barn. So the assassination has already taken place. And his life is about to end. I wonder if anything in particular prompted you to begin your book with this prologue set where it is at the very end of John Wilkes Booth's life. What do you think allow to happen then from there on in the novel?
Well, I wanted to focus on that moment, not only because it gives the reader a sense of what is coming, of what is going to be happening, but because it was really the only place that all four of my women narrators were ever together at once. And I don't mean that, of course, in a physical sense, but in the mind of John Wilkes Booth. Of course, Asia and Marianne, mother and daughter, were together quite often, but the other ladies never met them, and so they never were all four together. So I thought this was one way to bring them all together, because I'm very certain, or I'm, you know, again, it's not documented in the historical record, at least not all of it, but I'm quite sure that they would have been on his mind in those last hours. Now, some of it, it is in the historical record. Due to eyewitness accounts, and there were numerous, because all the Union soldiers and the member of the Garrett family who were there at his death, his last words were for his mother. It was very difficult for him to speak in those last hours, but he would repeatedly ask people who came nearby to check on his condition to pass on a message to his mother. But those were his last spoken words. Some of his last written words he had left with his sister Asia. Several months before the assassination, he had written a manifesto explaining why he felt justified to take on the action he was planning to take. And he sealed it in an envelope with other important documents, and he entrusted this to his sister and asked her to keep it for him in the safe in her Philadelphia home. She thought nothing of it. He was an actor, and so he traveled quite a lot, and it would have been imprudent for him to carry important documents around with him where they could be damaged or lost or stolen. So she thought nothing of it. It was only after his death that she went back to the safe and discovered what it was that she held. And then I think, too, he must have thought about Lucy Hale, his sweetheart, some even say secretly his fiancée, because he carried with him a pocket calendar, a journal, and in it he had photographs. Several actresses he knew from his work, and then a photograph or a portrait of Lucy Lambert Hale, the daughter of Senator John P. Hale from New Hampshire. So some people swear that they never knew each other at all. I think the fact that he carried her portrait shows that they were quite important to each other. And then I like to think that he did spare some thought, perhaps some regret for dragging Mary Surratt into the conspiracy, maybe some hope that she would not be brought down with him, although, as history tells us, if he had any hopes of that sort, they were in vain.
In the first chapter of the book, of course, we meet and really come to know and deeply sympathize with the mother of John Wilkes Booth, Mary Ann. And one of the things that is really intriguing here is that when she meets and falls in love with John Wilkes Booth's father, he is already married to someone else and has already had a child with them. And I think most of us, at least for the most part, recoil from such stories. I mean, it's that not the kind of thing that one easily approves of. I'm not sure I have ever read the story of, in a sense, an affair that about which I could feel such sympathy and deep understanding of why this occurred, and not that that made it right. But somehow you have created this. You've written about this relationship in such a way that we can deeply understand how it happened. Explain first of all, kind of what I'm talking about,
right,
and the care with which you wanted to write about this.
Well, and I do, I admit, have a bit of fear that when people learn that Mary Ann Holmes was essentially the other woman for whatever it was, 20-some years, I'm concerned that they will just take an immediate dislike to her and not really try to understand her or see where she's coming from. And I really hope that that doesn't happen. But, I can understand how it might. I certainly don't condone what they did. But when they met, Junius Brutus Booth was already a famous, successful actor. And Mary Ann Holmes was quite a bit younger, and she was working as a Covent Garden flower girl. And when she was reported to be very, very beautiful. And, of course, he was handsome and exciting and all of these wonderful things that so appealed to her. And it was almost love at first sight. She did not know until her heart was already just absolutely given over to him, that he was married. And in my novel, I have her wrestling with that. Other perhaps stronger people would have said, this isn't right, let's end it. But they did not choose to take that path. And they escaped together. They fled London, and they escaped to the United States, where Junius Brutus Booth began to launch a successful tour of the U.S. And Mary Ann was just supposed to be sort of in the background, but it was very difficult to keep her a secret. Newspapers would report on his travels, and more than one would mention that he was traveling with a beautiful woman. She was so striking that even objective reporters, many of them were inspired to note that, wow, what a beautiful traveling companion he has with him. So it was really, I think they were kidding themselves that they were going to be able to get away with this forever. And eventually it did catch up to them. So for anyone who might condemn them for what they did, and of course, as you said, it certainly was not right, they do pay the price for their choices. They don't get away with it, so to speak.
Right.
Eventually their secrets and their deception and the way that they wronged not only Junius Brutus Booth's wife, but also his son with her. They also had a son. They are forced to account for and atone for the choices that they made.
Right.
So they don't get away with anything.
No, absolutely not. They are engulfed in a very, very painful scandal, and it nearly leads to their economic ruin. At the very start of their romance, when Marianne Holmes has first learned that Junius is married, I really appreciate a moment in that painful conversation when she says, "Junius, we can't. You're too good a man to abandon your wife and child." And he answers, "I would do anything not to hurt them," he said. "Anything but abandon true love. Anything but suffer the torment of a lifetime without you." One of the things I appreciate about that little moment and many other moments in this entire chapter of the book is that we can imagine somebody like Junius, this acclaimed actor, speaking in this way.
Yes.
I mean, this feels like his voice. And it's also probably, to at least a large extent, the way language was used in the mid-19th century. Can you just say a word about that particular challenge of giving these various figures in the story an authentic voice, again, rooted in this moment in history?
Right. Well, in that particular line, I mean, it's very theatrical, but that is Junius Brutus Booth all over. I mean, he was, in important moments like this, he was on stage, wasn't he? I mean, he did not want to lose this beautiful, enchanting woman that he loved and who loved him in return. So, of course, I mean, anyone prone to theatrical statements, this is the time to pull one out. And, of course, it made Marianne almost swoon. I mean, she was very moved by this, and she agreed to do something that she knew deep down was wrong. She came from a very religious family, and it was an important part of her life as well. And yet, she was enchanted and loved him too, and believed that this was the right thing to do. You know, to there is the law, and then there's that greater law of true love, as they convince themselves. And I think in the back and forth, you can see that they are very often in trying to justify what they're doing and reinforcing what they're doing to each other with this kind of talk about that higher law of true love. And I do try to make the voices sound authentic to the period, but not to the extent that it would annoy a contemporary reader. I don't want these characters from the 19th century to sound and to act as if they are from 2016. I don't want to just take modern 21st century people and put them in period costumes and have them go around through the story. It's important to me to try to understand and to convey as best I can the values of the society that they were a part of, and that includes some of their attitudes toward relationships between members of the opposite sex or class issues, as well as the way they spoke to each other and in their letters as well. That was important too.
Right, and I hasten to add, I think you've really achieved that. That is, we have a sense of this being authentically the way they spoke, and yet you've done it just enough to give us that sense without making the language, in a sense, impenetrable or very foreign sounding to us. I think you've achieved an absolutely brilliant balance there, and I commend you for that. And when we get to the chapter that is devoted to John Wilkes Booth's sister, Asia, this is where we learn about the depths of poverty to which they sank after after the death of Junius. And it's in some ways one of the most difficult parts of the book to read. One of the ideas that is shared, I believe, I don't remember now who proposed this, but somebody who knew Mr. Booth from his theatrical exploits suggested that a biography be written about him. And it's in this portion of the book that we witness, in a sense, a scene involving his widow and the two children who had hoped to try to put this an amazing biography together about such an amazing man. Can you just say a word about this moment? Maybe you don't want to give everything away, but it's certainly a fascinating, powerful scene.
Yes, it's true. They were facing economic hardship, and they were still reeling from the loss of Junius Brutus Booth. And a family friend suggested that they write his biography. He suggested this to Marianne Holmes, or that they have someone write it, because if they didn't get out their own official version of his life story, they could be sure that any number of, you know, scandal mongers and others who would not be quite so sympathetic would get their own versions out there to the public and just change his legacy, change what was known about him for posterity. And Asia loved to write, and she thought that this would just be a wonderful project to undertake. She wanted to make sure that their father was remembered as the great man they all knew him to be. And she also thought that this would be a good way to keep her brother, John Wilkes Booth, occupied. He had been getting involved in politics, with the Know-Nothing party was emerging, and she was not entirely supportive of most of their platform, and she was a little concerned about seeing John being dragged into these different directions that she knew that their father would not have endorsed. And so she thought this would be a great project for them to work on together, and if it brought some much-needed income to the family, well, that would just be so much to the better. And they were discouraged in this by Marianne. She at first gave the project her reluctant blessing, but then when they brought out all of these wonderful trunks full of memorabilia and correspondence from their father's very lengthy career, she became very upset and concerned about private letters being divulged to the public. And all of this material belonged to her. They were her trunks. Everything inside of them really were her property. And she wanted it all destroyed. She wanted it all burned. And this was, of course, much against the wishes of her children, who wanted not only material for their book, but more importantly, this treasure trove of their father's life and career. And they did manage to save a few precious items, but most of it they had to watch as Marianne fed it into the flames.
Mm. It's an amazing scene. And it's so touching to read of Asia's devotion to her brother, whom she felt had in many respects been kind of unfairly treated, kind of gotten the short end of the stick in favor of his older brother, Edwin, who had ultimately gone on to become a tremendously successful actor in his own right. And it is Asia who actually encourages John Wilkes to pursue a similar sort of dream and helps him along his way. Her devotion to him, which of course lasted even after his infamous death, is certainly touching indeed. I so appreciate the chapter devoted to Lucy Hale. We've talked about her already, the daughter of a U.S. senator who may have been for a while the love of the life of John Wilkes. And one of the things I so appreciate about this is this: we come to understand how even a famous actor like John Wilkes Booth would not have been of the same social standing at all as a U.S. senator or his daughter. And it's really hard for us to kind of wrap our minds around that, given the fact that nowadays a famous actor or actress need not worry about anything of the sort.
Right.
But it was a very, very different world back then. I also appreciate, though, how you paint her parents and their concerns about this romance in such sympathetic light, because so often that is portrayed as nothing but heartless, unfeeling squashing of young love for the sake of social convention. And you paint a portrait of Lucy's parents that is much more compassionate than that.
Well, and I think, too, they knew their daughter very well, and she was very spirited. She was devoted and loving, but she also knew her own mind. And I think they had to tread very carefully the idea that if they forbade the relationship, it might make John Wilkes Booth all the more appealing. That certainly is something that often happens in young romantic relationships. So I think, too, it wasn't just the fact that he was not of their social class. Senators and their daughters did not see actors socially. It just was not done. Edwin, later on, he was so profoundly gifted that he certainly managed to break through that barrier. But at this point, it was John Wilkes Booth that was just not really happening in the North. And that's something that's important. In one letter that he wrote to his sister Asia before he was starting to contemplate the assassination or anything to bring down President Lincoln, he was, even before the war, he was in Richmond, Virginia, and he wrote to her talking about how wonderfully welcomed he felt in Richmond and in Virginia, and how there actors were not treated as a lesser sort of person, but were welcomed into the homes of the finest gentlemen. He talked about how the best families in Richmond invite me to dinner, and I am allowed to call on their ladies, and we're treated as equals. And so that was something that deeply impressed him. And that was why Virginia really became his adopted country. He was from Maryland, of course, but he loved Virginia. And I think part of it was because they showed him that respect and that admiration that he really had craved throughout his life. So, that was certainly very important to him. And I think, too, though, the parents, Senator and Mrs. Hale, they weren't simply guarded in their acceptance of this relationship simply because of his occupation. They had heard rumors that John Wilkes Booth was not the sort of upstanding character they would want their child to associate with, no matter what his profession might have been. He did not really, although he did, I think, conceal his political views from Lucy, he did not conceal them everywhere. He was sometimes quite loud in public places about his love for the South and his hatred for Lincoln, especially if he'd had a little too much to drink. And he was a frequent customer of a lot of the brothels in the sort of neighborhoods in the capital that Lucy and her family would never set foot in. So eventually this is going to trickle back to someone in a position of power who can make inquiries. So their concerns were about him as a suitor for their daughter were not only based upon social class.
Hmm. And of course, as this relationship plays out, we find ourselves really feeling for her as being caught in this situation where part of her understands her parents' concerns and her devotion to them prevents her from just discarding those concerns. And yet her heart is with John Wilkes Booth, even as she begins to learn bit by bit more and more disturbing things about him. It's a wrenching kind of love story that's played out, I suppose, all through human history.
Yes, and I think, too, we can see that when she looks back on it, when she can look back in hindsight and reflect upon all of these different signs that maybe her sweetheart is not everything she thinks he is, we can see the signs. The signs were there. But as you're in it in the moment, and there's a little slip of the tongue here and a strange, bizarre, angry outburst here, if you love someone and if you want to keep loving them, you can find ways to rationalize away whatever they're saying that you don't particularly care for. When you're a young person in love, you can especially practice the art of denial quite a lot. And it's only afterward that Lucy's really able to see, okay, this I can put this together with this, and I can see how he really felt. And I think that's a question she had to ask herself later on, and I imagine that it troubled her later in life. She loved him very much, but she would have to wonder, I think, for the rest of her life, did he truly love her, or was it just a pretense? She admired Abraham Lincoln very much. She was a senator's daughter. She was very good friends with Lincoln's eldest son, Robert Lincoln. They were, you know, they were very good friends. She was also very good friends with one of his private secretaries, John Hay. So did John Wilkes Booth truly love her, or was she just a means to an end?
Hmm.
Was she just a way for him to possibly get access to President Lincoln to do him harm? I have to believe that she must have wondered about that after that night in April.
One would think so. She was an intelligent young woman. And at one point, this is what you write, as she is beginning to feel more and more confusion about her feelings for him. And yet he, meaning Booth, was occasionally ill-tempered and abrupt, only to be smiling, affectionate, and courteous as ever the next time Lucy saw him. His mood seemed to shift with the wind, turning Lucy this way and that, like a weather vane, powerless to hold fast against bewilderment and hurt. We finish out by just talking for a couple moments about Mary Surratt, who, of course, as we said earlier, was one of the four conspirators tried and convicted and ultimately hung. As I touched on earlier, one of the things I find so striking about the way you have painted this portrait, so to speak, is that we have this sense of how she viewed these events of 1864 and 1865 with the deterioration of the Confederacy and ultimately their defeat. And of course, what's the saying? History is written by the victors.
Right.
And in a sense, we all tend to see the end of the Civil War only from the perspective of and through the eyes of the triumphant Northerners. But you paint this picture of someone who had to listen to those church bells ring with the joyous sounds of victory, knowing that her beloved South had just gone down to defeat. Returning to a question I posed to you earlier, what did it feel like for you to try to put yourself into the shoes of someone like Mary Surratt?
It was challenging. It certainly was. But that's really what writing historical fiction is all about. You have to really delve into the mind and the understanding of the people that you choose to be your characters. And I had written about Civil War era Washington, D.C. before, but always from a Union sympathizer's point of view, whether it was Elizabeth Keckley, who was Mrs. Lincoln's dressmaker, or Julia Grant, the wife of the general of all the Union armies, and others too. So I think it was very different, but also, therefore, very fascinating to write from a perspective of someone who was not celebrating as the illuminations were going up, who did not rejoice and fill the streets and join the other people celebrating the end of the war, but to write from this other point of view. But Mary Surratt certainly was not alone. For all that Washington, D.C. was the capital of the Union, it was, in many respects, a southern city until President Lincoln managed to get slavery abolished in D.C. It was a slave region. It was slave territory. It was not, you know, New Hampshire, where Lucy hailed from, which was a free state. And there were many people who had resided there for a long time, the kind of established social elite, who also were from southern states. So it was kind of a very precarious place to be.
For someone of Mary's persuasion, but she was not alone.
No, she certainly was not. Yeah.
You write this at one point. This is as that news has been received that Petersburg and Richmond have fallen. The Confederate capital has fallen. Later, all Mary remembered of that long, dreadful, disquieting afternoon was the harshness of the light, the grating quality of the music, the jittery chattering of fireworks, the bone-shaking thunder of distant cannon. Elsewhere, she knew, down the street or around the corner, other Washington households had plunged into mourning, too. But they could not seek out one another for comfort, not that day, when to grieve was to commit treason. That's a brief excerpt from the novel Fates and Traitors, a novel of John Wilkes Booth by best-selling author Jennifer Chiaverini. Jennifer Chiaverini comes to the Northside Kenosha Public Library on Wednesday, the 28th, for a book signing. And we will be playing another portion of this conversation on Wednesday's morning show. Monday on the morning show, we'll be talking about